various organizational groups is their liaison effectiveness with other parts of the community. During the great boycott in support of Cesar Chavez, which I guess it was about 10 years ago, they were picketing all the stores because they were handling non-union grapes and passing out leaflets. And I didn't mind, I didn't buy grapes, but that was a personal matter. I was very interested to see the interesting transition in Pittsburgh, whereas Rado Shalom, which was supposedly the home of the more conservative, business-minded members of the community, had its young people's group not only endorse the boycott, but visit the merchants on Murray Avenue and ask them not to handle non-union grapes, which to my mind was quite a transition, or maybe verified that I've been holding stereotypical views. But anyway, when they passed out the leaflets in front of the Giant Eagle markets, they personalized it with something that said, "Mr. Shapiro, aren't you ashamed to have accepted the Humanitarian of the Year Award from the UJF when you are selling grapes contributing to the poverty of workers in California and so forth?" It was highly personal and kept saying, "Mr. Shapiro, Mr. Shapiro, UJF, and so forth. It even mentioned disparagingly the fact that one of these Shapiro boys, I think it was Daniel, had gone out and helped the grape workers personally. This is a very fine family if you ever get to know them beyond the business end. And Frida Shapiro, of course, is very active in social-minded activities. They had a booth at the AFL-CIO convention, and I went to see the fellow who had written the flyer. And I said, he happened to be a minister. I said, "Don't you realize how anti-Semitic this is?" He said, "No, Mr. Shapiro is the head of the organization," and we addressed him. I said, "Art, who is the head of AFP? I don't know. What's his religion? I don't know. Who's the head of Kroger's?" I went through all these other things. I said, "Are you going to now pass out a leaflet saying, 'Mr. Huntington Hartford, you miserable Episcopalian?'" He said, "No, that's ridiculous." And he just didn't understand how anti-Semitic this was. So I got very angry about it, and I went to see Paul Stackhouse, who was the head of the county AFL-CIO, the Allegheny County AFL-CIO, who was a very good friend of mine. Now, when he heard about it, he quickly recognized its anti-Semitic nature, and not only that, was very angry because Giant Eagle had an excellent relationship with organized labor. So he stood up, made a motion, and they unanimously passed a resolution to throw this booth off the floor for that reason. This was all of organized labor from Western Pennsylvania. I then stepped in and mediated it personally. The fellow finally realized how serious this was, and I got them to agree that it was all right to picket, but that they could not have literature of this sort. The other thing that I apprised them of was that Giant Eagle was the only place that sold union grapes, and they bought every pound that they could find in the Pittsburgh market. There weren't enough to fill up their customer demand, and they filled out the difference with non-union grapes, whereas all the other stores had 100% non-union grapes, and yet the most scurrilous leaflet went to Giant Eagle. That was a personal experience. These opportunities come up from time to time, and they'd use them.
Any other organizations?
I'm interested, of course, in national organizations like Americans for Democratic Action, Public Citizen, Common Cause, things of that sort, but these are national, where I just act as a contributor, but not in an active sense. Well, another organization which I've worked with very actively as an offshoot is the Pittsburgh Mediation Center. Now, this was started by a few interested people to train persons to help mediate neighborhood disputes. Let us say you had a neighborhood that was integrating and you had black-white differences. a trained person could go in and try to work it out instead of their settling it in the old-fashioned way of beating each other up or vandalism or anything of that sort, or someone who is too poor to go to a justice of peace or anything of that sort. Your kids are making a lot of noise and I can't sleep. You know, that, whether it might be petty or serious things. So I've worked with them as a resource person. I'm on the board of that group, and I'm a resource person with the divorce mediation group, which is a comparatively recent organization which tries to get divorces worked out without litigation and all the expenses that go with it.
Okay, do you want to reflect on Jewish-Black relationships as they have evolved in your time and the trends you think they may take?
Well, I'm really concerned about Jewish-Black relationships as of today. Jews have always been in the forefront, the active forefront, sometimes being the only whites at all involved in the NAACP, Urban League, and so forth. They've always been out there because it's part of our tradition to care about anybody else that is being hurt. Now, over the years, this has continued on, but during recent years, there have been certain strains that have developed. The Andy Young incident, with when he was with the United representative of the United Nations and met with the PLO and then was separated by the president. He made no such accusations, but such well-liked people as Julian Bond, who are well-respected in the white Jewish community, claimed it was Jewish pressure and so forth. But Jews still have been very active. I mentioned Frieda Shapiro before, who has been was a prime mover in creating the Pittsburgh Human Relations Commission. And I'm sure the Jews were involved in the state human relations and other movements. Even the law that I handled primarily, the wage and hour law, was lobbied for by Jewish groups, and you'll find that's true today. In recent years, though, there have been the most recent phenomena have been Jesse Jackson and Louis Farrakhan. Now, two things have been happening. One has been that, and the other has been that Jews have been moving more and more into the middle class. And in many respects, they are beginning to resemble more and more their entire white income group. One of the evidences of it is increased alcoholism among Jews, whereas that was unthinkable years ago. They are becoming more and more like other Jews, called an aspect of assimilation, like other whites. And this same aspect of assimilation has meant that there has been the either creation or releases of prejudices, which are more common to the entire white group. During the Jesse Jackson campaign, and then especially the Farrakhan period, I was involved in the Pittsburgh end of it as a member of the Community Relations Committee. When Farrakhan was coming to town, there were great efforts made to have black leaders, so to speak up against Farrakhan. The fact is they didn't. Now, it can be understood because so-called black leaders are leaders some, perhaps only in the eyes of whites who recognize them as black leaders. Or on the other hand, they might have felt that they might be called Uncle Toms. Or perhaps they were reflecting the true a higher level of anti-Semitism than we'd be willing to admit. But it has been very, very difficult, especially since Farrakhan's visit, to work effectively on black-Jewish relations. I haven't been on any direct committees I've been interested in indirectly, but there is an enormous amount of anti-black feeling. There is also the removal of one of the weapons that blacks were able to use and which might have involved Jewish merchants, and that is that the development of shopping centers versus individual stores means that, and also absentee ownership and corporate ownership is such you can't even identify whom to boycott. So that one of the remarks, a crude remark with which I roundly disagree, but which is, probably has some truth, is a statement of one person which says, they need us more than we need them. They are the disadvantaged, we're fortunately the advantaged. And even if it is true, it doesn't remove our obligation, in my mind, to care about any kind of discrimination, which may extend a couple steps further and include Jews. But at the moment, I'm quite pessimistic about it. But it's a momentary thing. It's a dynamic. And my attitude is that there's still no choice but to battle for fair play. And that doesn't mean turning the other cheek.
Okay. Do you want to reflect on the local labor union leaders of the 30s or 40s or maybe even the 20s?
Well, because of my age, I barely knew any except as friends of my father during the 20s. I think I told you that my dad was an officer of the cigar makers local here, and Samuel Gompers was the national president, so that he would visit the house from all accounts, but that would have been in the the 1915-17 period. I was born in 17. During the 30s, I was interested. I remember picking up a picket sign and helping Father Rice, who recently retired, when he was picketing a restaurant on Craig Street. I even remember the name was called a culinaire, and it was because they got no wages, and it was a depression, they got no tips, and the waitresses were out. So I was walking by, and he told me about it, and I picked up the sign and put it on. So I was always interested in unions, and would help to pass out leaflets for the Steelworkers Organizing Committee, which then became the United Steelworkers. Would attend meetings of various unions, and saw this fantastic rate of organization that was going on all around you. Almost overnight, Allegheny County became the most highly unionized area in the world. In fact, it still is. There are more union people per thousand among the employees in Allegheny County than anywhere else in the world today. So one was able to see this dynamic. You also saw these ghetto neighborhoods. Ours was a Jewish neighborhood. Over the hill was Polish Hill, the Italian section towards town, the Syrian section over towards Conley, the Greek section over to near where, I guess, the Carlton House was, and that area where Robert Morris was, the Lithuanian section down near the Brady Street Bridge and so forth. And these were all people who had some of the European entities and which were brought together through the union. That is, they came together for a common purpose. So I felt that the union movement had a great sociological effect in breaking down these narrow lines. Philip Murray, the first president of the steelworkers, insisted upon English and Americanization classes for the members. Organizers, for the first time, went out and spoke native languages rather than just English. Before that, unions were pretty much dominated by Anglo-Saxon leaders. So here you had an Eastern and Southern European and black unions as well. They did a great deal to erase a lot of these lines. I think I mentioned that Webster Hall was the only hotel that allowed blacks in at the time. And as a result, a lot of the union banquets and meetings were held there. Later on, the other hotels relented. I remember, I think I mentioned before, Nat King Cole being denied a hotel room downtown. He had to find one up on the hill. These things have happened within a fairly limited span. We're talking about 50 years, and it's still coming a long way, baby, we have.
Do you find Jews as involved with labor today as they used to be?
No. There are people who have been in the past. Dan Malinger is his dad was with the Steelworkers Union, is the head of the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists here. But others have gone in other directions. Ben Fisher, who was one of the higher people in the Steelworkers, has retired, and he heads a labor institute over at Carnegie Mellon. There aren't Jews, by and large. First of all, they were kept out of the working class by discrimination. They were almost forced to become small entrepreneurs on their own. So there were never a large number of Jews in the workforce. You might have had it in Philadelphia, New York, with the garment industry and so forth. But not so much Pittsburgh, where a minority were working in enterprises that unionized. Now, there were a large number who were on the in key positions in unions, in the steelworkers, a great number of them. I'm trying to think of his first name, Ruttenberg. Harold Ruttenberg was the research director for the Steelworkers Union in his day. Now, he and his wife were very active during the 30s. They worked with the unemployed councils, movements of that sort. But then he is an entrepreneur, you see, and probably has nothing actively to do with organized labor.
Okay, are there any areas that we haven't touched on that you would like to reflect on?
No, I can't think of anything particular. One of the things that I was thinking of on the way over here is a kind of a contradiction in self, and that is that I have seen so many success stories of for individuals who have worked hard and done pretty well. I've seen so many Operation Bootstrap stories that one can tell about people with whom one grew up in the old hill, that on a personal level, it's very, very difficult to be that critical of the capitalist system. You know, that there are opportunities. On the other hand, the one sweeps under the rug and sometimes never sees the abysmal failures and hurt that goes with it. I'm interested in the overall picture, and there I think I can be much more critical, and that is that we see the incidence of poverty rising, the disparities in wealth growing, so that it's an almost abstract idea, because personally, I have enough, and my children, I think, will have enough. My friends, I think, have enough. Now, if you want to let narrow your vision to that perspective, you stop right there. I think, though, there is a responsibility to others to see what one can do to have fair housing, fair opportunity, to make sure that the kid who graduates from Stowe Rocks High School has as much of a chance of going to college and of making it as a kid who graduates from Mount Lebanon High School. They aren't there, even the quality of care. You look at the trap that the poor are in. You take a kid who's born on the hill, who's born to parents who don't have the kind of education to give him much training before he goes to school. He's in a school system and in neighborhoods where he is getting inferior education. In spite of the best efforts of the board, he still has a relationship to those in his class. Then comes out, and then he's got to compete in the world with people who graduated from other areas. He doesn't have much of a chance. We're in a competitive system. You can't blame an employer for wanting to hire the best that he can get. So we have a perpetuation of this syndrome. We begin to have third, fourth, and fifth generation welfare. And I don't think one can in good conscience sit still so long as we have things of that sort.
What's your advice?
Well, I can't be a seer. It's always nibbling at it wherever you get your chance, whether it is employment, trying to promote with one's congressman, employment bills that may give employment opportunities and training opportunities to the less trained unemployed, or maybe having the government as an employer of last resort may be a matter of examining national priorities to see whether enormous sums spent on defense are that necessary as compared with lesser sums spent on food stamp programs so that kids will not be nutritionally deficient. It might be pressure upon the government to make the Food and Drug Administration really do its job rather than be concerned as to whether NutraSweet is carcinogenic. These are little things. There are no big things. At one time, there were big things when you had a dynamic liberal labor movement or a New Deal party. There you could almost do it on a group basis. Now it's almost individual things. Should I or should I not send so much money to Ralph Nader? It's a day-to-day kind of things that one can suggest, but I have no overall prescription.
Okay. I think Marcia and I wish you many years of good health.
Thank you.
But how would you like to be remembered?
As a mensch. It's as simple as that. I think that if I can be remembered as someone who gave a damn, who never deliberately hurt anyone, all right. I don't want to be remembered as someone who was that perfect, because perfectly remembered people are disembodied and are not really believed. So in a recitation of this sort, I think I've done the human thing, and that is to make sure that I expose as few of my foibles as possible, and I intend to continue to do that.
Marcia, do you have anything
to add? No, I believe, unless there was something that stayed in your memory that you wanted to, like your Giant Eagle story, is there anything else, another story of that sort?
Well, yeah, I could give you one more story, and that is that I always find that one may have an idea and explain it, but that doesn't mean that the other person understands it. And one has to learn how to use various means of convincing others. I recall, for example, that I had a student in one of my classes who was the assistant director of personnel at Heinz. This was 25 years ago. And she complained about the high rate of absenteeism and the poor attitude of the employees, who were heavily female. Now, I knew that at that time, Heinz did not hire blacks, or hired very few of them. So I talked with her and I said, why don't you examine the position of the female help that you have in the Pittsburgh labor market? And she did that, and she said, well, we're lower paying than other jobs. The food industry is a lower paying job. So I said, then you're getting the bottom of the barrel. I said, why don't you think of hiring black women for whom this would be a higher paying job, and be at the height of the barrel, because you'll find that black women will prefer to work in hospitals rather than work as domestics, even though there the wages are somewhat about the same or lower. She thought about that, and I think that as a result of that, they began to hire black women in greater number. She told me later on that although there was some tension from the white women, after that passed, they felt that the productivity had actually gone up. Now, there you approach it in terms of cold dollars and cents, the employer buying the best available help he could get for the money he was offering. So the quality of the black women he could get for that money, since black women were disadvantaged in the labor market, was greater than getting the bottom segment of the white women. See? So there one used one's classroom as a means of doing it. But yet she did it. I used the Socratic method. Check this out. See if this will work and so forth. I know at the back of my mind I had the hope that it would work, the more black women would to be hired, and they were. So at least that's the result as reported to me. There are various instances that come up, and I guess it's like being at a storytelling session. You don't remember any story until somebody mentions one, and then you think of three. And I suppose this recitation has been in that thing.
Thanks, Hyde, for a great interview.
I enjoyed it.
Thank you. It's been very.
Gave you a chance to think about where you're at.